This is Only a Game. I'm J.A. Adande. After a recent game, Milwaukee Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo left the locker room and walked the green-tinted hallway at Fiserv Forum. Beside him, walking stride for stride and chatting, was a reporter with a reddish-brown beard named Kane Pittman. The two talk often, both on the record and just for fun. They could have a legitimate debate about whose How I Got to Milwaukee story is crazier. Antetokounmpo's journey is by now well known. He grew up in Athens, Greece, the son of Nigerian immigrants. Now he's the likely MVP of the NBA. And that red-bearded reporter? Dan Simmons brings us his story.
The home team won the first four games of this series. Then Charlotte won in Milwaukee in Game 5, and Milwaukee...
May 20th, 2001. Milwaukee Bucks versus Charlotte Hornets. NBA playoffs second round. You probably remember nothing about that series. But Kane Pittman, he remembers.
That's really when I took note of basketball, and Milwaukee won that game, and Ray Allen played really well.
And Allen comes out of the pack for Milwaukee. Takes it all away!
Ray Allen, you know, ended up being my favorite basketball player to watch. The crowd was just insane.
The crowd really into it now.
I was like, you know, this team's pretty cool.
Kane was 11 years old. He'd come across the game flipping channels while sitting on his parents' couch in Geelong, Australia. That's the town near Melbourne where Kane grew up. The Bucks play 9,800 miles away. At first, Kane just followed the team by checking out the box scores. Then he started getting online radio feeds of Bucks games. As soon as he could afford it, he bought NBA League Pass to watch the games.
So yeah, I really haven't missed a game, whether it's radio or, you know, watching for a long, long time, like maybe 2005.
For a while, Kane thought about pursuing a career as a writer, but as his high school graduation approached...
I sort of got to the end of high school and I thought to myself that I didn't want to go to school anymore. I just wanted to get to work and earn money and do that sort of stuff. So I sort of pushed that aside.
Just 4 days after finishing high school, Kane started working the graveyard shift at a massive oil refinery. His dad worked there too.
It was hot. It was really, really hot. And in summer in Australia, you know, you could have a 120 degree day or 40 plus degrees Celsius, and you're out there in overalls and hard hat and working with 500 degree products and that sort of stuff. So it was hard work.
When he wasn't working, Kane could often be found playing Australian rules football. His love for footy, as Aussies call it, was pretty typical. His love for the Milwaukee Bucks was not, especially back before the Bucks drafted Australian Andrew Bogut with the number one overall pick in the 2005 draft. The NBA wasn't very popular in Australia, and the Bucks consistently ranked near the bottom of the NBA standings. But no matter, they were Kane's team since he first fell for them in 2001, even though for him, their games tipped off mid-morning. After work, Kane would watch replays of the games, and he'd do his best during the day to avoid finding out the results.
I would go to sort of extreme levels, I guess. I would just like be all right, phones off for the day, because my friend knew that this is what I would do. So they would like text me and say, well, the Bucks played really well today, or something like that. The people, they used to laugh at me for doing that, because they would know if they needed to contact me on the day the Bucks played, like, I'm off the grid. You like, you can't get onto me, so.
In 2015, Kane hit a crossroads. He tore his ACL. He spent his rehab doing what else? Watching the Bucks, who finished with a 500 record and made it to the first round of the playoffs. Kane flew to Milwaukee to watch their playoff series against the Chicago Bulls in person. Milwaukee felt comfortable, a mid-sized city in the shadow of a nearby metropolis, kind of like Geelong.
It felt pretty familiar, obviously a little bit colder, I would say that. It was a little bit colder.
The Bucks lost the series, but the trip got Kane thinking more about bigger questions in his life. The job at the refinery paid the bills but didn't satisfy him. He was in his mid-20s and started thinking back to his teenage years and his dreams of becoming a writer.
I was like, I think that I've watched enough basketball, been around enough basketball that I feel like I have the knowledge that I can actually do this.
In the wee hours of the morning, when the oil refinery didn't need tending, Kane practiced writing. An editor at the Pick and Roll, an Australian basketball blog, became his mentor. Kane asked his editor to be critical because he knew it was the only way he'd learn.
You know, there was times where I would write big features for them and write them four times because he's like, look, I don't think this is, you want to publish this. I don't think this is good for you.
Kane stuck with it. Last season, he took another big leap. He traveled to California to see the Bucks on a road trip, but he wasn't just a spectator anymore. He was on assignment and came upon Matthew Dellavedova, an Australian who happened to play for the Bucks.
They practiced at a little high school gym in Beverly Hills, and I showed up. He was out with an ankle injury at the time, so the whole team left. all the other reporters that were there left. So I hung around by myself and ended up getting him by myself for sort of 5 to 10 minutes. As soon as I started talking, he was like, oh, where, you know, where are you from? And then I, you know, he's from Melbourne himself or just outside of Melbourne. So then it makes it easy. You can talk about things outside of basketball.
The editor started to come around to Kane's writing and he planted a seed.
He sort of floated the idea first and said to me that, you know, you're putting in the work. If you want this to actually be a career, then it's not going to be easy, but we can get you a foreign media visa, get you over there, and you can work as a freelancer. And then we got to the point in August last year, so the NBA season was roughly 2 months away, and he sort of just messaged me and said, look, if you want to do this, then I think it would be in your best interest to be there for the start of the season.
By this point, the Bucks had become a far better story. The team of nobodies that Kane had followed for a decade had become an up-and-coming contender, thanks largely to Giannis Antetokounmpo, or as he's commonly known, the Greek Freak. Kane decided to go, but first, he had to stockpile cash. The visa he'd carried through pickandroll.com would forbid him from making money from American companies. He knew to plan for a year of little or even zero income.
I just worked a lot. I mean, I was working, you know, 70-hour weeks and rotating between days and night shifts. So, yeah, I was angry and tired all the time. But in the back of my mind, I knew that if this is what I wanted to do and I wanted to make it work, then I wasn't going to be thinking about working those hours when I got over here and I was covering NBA games. I'm like, well, it's going to be worth it in the end.
Kane worked nearly 3 months straight. Even when he was home, he couldn't calm his nerves enough to get much shut-eye. He was about to move to a city where he knew only a handful of people to do a job that probably wouldn't pay, with everyone and everything familiar a 24-hour flight from him. In early October, days before the Bucks season was to begin, Kane packed 2 suitcases and boarded a one-way flight to Milwaukee.
Once I got on the plane, I think I was cool with it. I was like, all right, this is like going to be an adventure. We'll see what happens.
Once in Milwaukee, getting a press pass with the Bucks was actually easy. Arranging an apartment proved tougher.
They wanted to know my weekly income to get the lease. So that provided some challenges because I was trying to explain, which is ridiculous, I was trying to explain to the landlord that I don't have a weekly income, but I have savings. This is what I'm trying to do. I'm going to do some freelance stuff. And he was like, well, how much are you going to earn? I'm like, I don't know. That's out of my control. Hopefully enough so that I can eat.
The Bucks have 2 other beat reporters, Matt Velasquez of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Eric Name of The Athletic. The trio became close friends, exchanging wisecracks before press conferences and ribbing each other on Twitter. One difference, the other two are salaried and travel on expense accounts. Kane pays his own way. Sometimes that means he has to get creative.
Back in October, yeah, it ended up being a 1 a.m. bus from Milwaukee to Minneapolis. I just didn't want to pay for that hotel the night before. So I got to Minneapolis in the early hours of the morning, 6, 7 a.m. maybe, I think. Dropped my stuff off at the hotel. Room wasn't ready. Had some breakfast. Went to practice. Everyone told me I was looking pretty rough. And then I, after that, went back to the hotel. Quick nap. Worked the game. Was out 5 o'clock the next morning. So, you know, when I think about the money I saved on that trip, it's a $20 bus ticket as opposed to a $250 flight. Those are the things that I had to do if I wanted to still be here in May.
Kane quickly went from a curiosity to a trusted colleague and a go-to on Twitter for Bucks fans. Although he didn't make every road trip, he did make it out west later in the season. After covering the team's morning shoot-around, Kane and the other Bucks reporters found themselves in a you-can't-make-this-up moment while walking back to the hotel. A familiar face appeared.
So Giannis is walking down the streets of downtown San Francisco, Bucks jersey, ice wrapped around his knees, and we were walking with him at the time. And we were like, you know, we were talking to him and joking and laughing around. And we got to eventually to an intersection where we were going to keep going straight, and they were going right to the hotel. So me, Matt, and Eric got halfway across the road, and then we like heard Giannis like yelling out to us. And he was like, guys, we're going this way. The hotel's this way. And we're like, Giannis, we don't stay in your hotel, okay? You're like the MVP of the NBA. We just write about you. We don't stay at your hotel. Like, it's okay. Thanks for caring about us, but we're going to get some lunch.
As 2018 turned into 2019 and Milwaukee's brutal winter gave way to spring, the Bucks just kept winning. They secured the best regular season record in the NBA. They swept their first-round series with the Detroit Pistons. It marked the franchise's first playoff series win since 2001, when 11-year-old Kane Pittman had caught Bucks fever. Next came a second-round series with the Boston Celtics, who had knocked them out in the first round last year. This year, it wasn't close.
Giannis straight down the lane and a foul!
Bucks in five. Kane's apartment lease ended May 1st. Back in October, he figured the season may be winding down by then, but he was able to extend a month to month, and those midnight winter bus rides saved him enough that he can fly to away games throughout the rest of the Bucks' playoff run. By some measures, he is living a dream, but there's one small drawback.
You know, being freelance and pitching stories and not hearing back from people and thinking, well, okay, well, where am I going to get my next money from? And that's when, you know, you start to stress a little bit and then think, well, is anything going to come for this, or am I just going to go home and realize that I blew all my savings for the last 10 years, you know? So, because I think when I first moved here, I tried to tell myself that if it didn't work out, you'll say, well, I had a fun year and a good experience, and you go home and do what you were doing. But once I got here and realized that, I was like, no, actually, I don't want to go home and go back to what I was doing. This is what I want to do.
Kane is still waiting for a job offer that will allow him to stay in Milwaukee and keep covering the Bucks. In the meantime, Bucks Nation has gotten to know the reporter from Australia with the reddish-brown beard. Early in the season, Kane didn't ask me anything on Reddit. Later, his story found a bigger audience through a feature on TheRinger.com. And fans are reaching out to say how inspired they are by his story. His message back to them is simple.
I'm 28, and you know, I think a lot of people are scared to change what they're doing once they get to that sort of point and feel like they should be doing other things with their life, but I don't believe that's true. If you aren't happy, and I wasn't really happy with what I was doing, why would I keep doing that for another 30 years?
That story came to us from reporter Dan Simmons. We'll have a link to that Ringer story at onlyagame.org. Only a Game's Gary Wallach had a chance meeting with Celtics center Rick Roby after Game 2 of the 1981 NBA Finals.
It was a game, I think, that we ended up losing at home, correct?
Correct.
What else does Roby remember? The answer is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef. Traceability so bold that customers can even know the genetic pedigree of their steak or burger. From a six-generation family ranch in the Nebraska Sandhills, Honest Beef is dedicated to telling the story of your beef. Follow along on Instagram to see their life on the ranch, working to provide their customers with high-quality, dry-aged beef that they can feel great about. From their ranch to your door, they'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
I'm J.A. Adande, and it's time for three stories you should know. This week, we're talking about everything from the college admissions scandal to Game of Thrones. I'm joined by the Undefeated's Lonnae O'Neill and The Ringer's Claire McNear. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I'll start off. Surely you recall the outrage that swept across the nation when we learned of the college admission scandal. That story included allegations of rich parents paying six-figure sums to get their kids into elite schools using athletic exceptions, even though their kids didn't play the sports. But you'll notice no one gets upset when students who might not meet the academic standards get into schools because they actually are great athletes. That's because there's a chance their talent can bring glory to dear old alma mater. There only seems to be a problem when these players get rewarded with money for their abilities. A recent FBI investigation into the underbelly of college basketball resulted in convictions and plea deals for assistant coaches, shoe company representatives, and would-be agents who threw money around to secure players' services. Most of the offenders are African American. So far, we've seen sentences of 6 to 9 months, with more to come. In the college admissions scandal, out of 50 people facing charges, 16 people have pleaded guilty so far, and most of them are white. Prosecutors have recommended everything from no prison time to 46 months in prison. I'm curious to see which group of offenders will end up getting punished more severely and what that will say about our justice system's priorities.
Yeah, I mean, what's been interesting for me to see is that in both cases, prosecutors have been kind of trying to make the argument that the universities themselves are the victims, which is, shall we say, a tenuous proposition to start with. And it's especially galling in the case of athletics, when those same schools, very, very wealthy schools for the most part, are making so much money off the athletes who, in some cases, may have received some money from this scheme, which is sort of what led to the criminal charges in the first place. So what has been heartening to me, at least in kind of watching the college basketball case progress a little bit, is it does seem like the juries in those cases maybe haven't fully bought at least that aspect of it, that the universities are victims. And we'll see if that is also true in the college admissions scandal. But, you know, it's a pretty out there thing to advance.
I agree, Claire. The notion of the universities as victims, though, really sticks in my craw. When it comes to athletics, they're victims of not having complete control of these athletes' lives and bodies and finances and thought processes and independent decision-making capacities, so that it takes away potentially from their ability to, you know, have their PR victories or to monetize it, right? Setting themselves up as a victim is really pretty noxious.
Yeah, it was really preposterous, I would argue.
Yeah, and I mean, they're clearly benefiting just over and over and over. You know, as each season goes by, they are benefiting in just the most concrete of ways. And here they are kind of holding themselves up to be pitied and, you know, remunerated maybe. So it's just pretty absurd.
And I made the case that really the victims could be the people who are being prosecuted. In many cases, the assistant coaches who are put in this position of doing everything they can to secure the best players that they can for their schools. That's their job. This is the way the game is played. There is a lot of money under the table that's being thrown around. And so by playing by the rules of this game, they were the ones who were busted and could face jail time, even though, you know, there really was no victim. No one was really damaged in this. No laws were broken necessarily, more so NCAA violations. And it really seems absurd.
There's a level of hysteria when it comes to the notion of thinking that Black athletes might have some unfair advantage, or that, you know, a Black middleman or assistant coach might be reaching out in a way that is inaccessible to other people. And when you put the overlay, when you sort of undergird that with a Black body, right, the hypocrisy just goes over the moon.
Absolutely. Lane, it's time for your topic. What do you have for us?
Okay, so Elisa Montaño, she's a middle distance runner. In 2014, she ran in the U.S. Track and Field Championships at 8 months pregnant. She, for Mother's Day, had an editorial in the New York Times where she talked about the toll that being a pregnant athlete took on her in terms of her economics, in terms of sponsorship with companies like Nike. Built into that calculation to be a mother and an athlete is an economic insecurity and real health challenges, right? Because you get your sponsorship snatched or pulled or cut back. So that incentivizes an athlete to take risks, to try to hide their pregnancy, to try to come back before they're able to. So that started this couple of weeks of just news about these issues. Allison Felix, who's a sprinter, testified before Congress about maternal risk and mortality, particularly difficult for Black mothers who risk dying in pregnancy 3 to 4 times more than their white counterparts. She was one of them, and she had an emergency cesarean section at 32 weeks. And then I wrote about Natasha Hastings, a 4x400-meter relay gold medalist who is pregnant now, and she just announced on social media, even though she's 5.5 months pregnant, because she was afraid of what her sponsors would do.
Claire, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think when Serena Williams first kind of came out with the story of giving birth a while back now, she had this terrible kind of emergency happen right after she gave birth. It was a life-threatening situation, and she has struggled with blood clots. I think people were shocked. I mean, you hear abstractly about a maternal health crisis and one that, you know, disproportionately affects the African-American community, but you don't think of it as something that happens here or now. And it's amazing to see athletes like Williams and like Natasha Hastings who've gone through so much and who are, you know, fighting both to receive just, just the basic kind of maternal rights as athletes and as working mothers.
You know, if Nike can stand by athletes and honor the contracts of athletes who are in the middle of controversy, we see them do it all the time, right? Most notably Colin Kaepernick. But yeah. They can't stand by women who are pregnant. And then almost simultaneously, we've had some very restrictive abortion laws being approved in various states. It's interesting how these two conversations are walled off, basically. Look at the pushback women are facing when they're trying to have children. And also, if we're seeing these examples of African-American women in top-level physical condition, if we're seeing them gravely threatened by wanted pregnancies, think about the physical danger that African-American women in worse condition with unwanted pregnancies could face. And we're not having that discussion at all.
Absolutely. There's what Alison Felix called a culture of silence. And talking with some of these athletes, if you do not have bodily autonomy, you cannot be a top-level athlete. You can't be an athlete, period. You can't compete. So questions about abortion, questions about pregnancy and timing and healthcare are all central to the question of, do we really want to even have female athletes? And if so, what kinds of supports, economic, legislative, in terms of public policy, these have to be the upfront conversations.
Claire, what do you have for us?
So bear with me for a second. I'm going to talk about Game of Thrones. There was a lot of criticism of Game of Thrones in its final season, which wrapped up last weekend. A lot of folks, myself included, felt that everything was a little bit rushed and that, you know, some of the character development was perhaps a bit flawed. And here's a minor spoiler coming, so cover your ears for the next 30 seconds or so if you've, you know, somehow avoided the news of how it shook out with the Iron Throne. But I just wanted to give a shout out to Arya Stark, who was maybe the only major character whose arc made any sense by the end of Game of Thrones. She literally rides off into the sunset, or sails off anyway. And, you know, she learned the lessons of life and love, and it's pretty great. But what I wanted to talk about more broadly, which I think is sort of the bigger thing with Game of Thrones and is maybe the more relevant one for our purposes, Game of Thrones was not obviously within the domain of sports, but I would say that it's about as close as you can get without a referee. You know, it was appointment viewing every Sunday night. And everybody's on social media reacting in real time. Everybody's talking about it the next day at work. Can you believe who did this and who won or who lost? And, it, you know, it feels like this might be one of the last TV shows that this element is true of.
And I definitely thought there was a sports-like component. Unfortunately, that didn't apply when it came to the end of the series and the discussion that followed. And in sports, we understand that our team might not win. Like, we go in and we by definition, there's going to be a loser. But in TV, we demand and expect victories all the time. Well, guess what? They have the possibility of losing too, right? Of not getting a ride, of not fulfilling our expectations when it comes to the way the story plays out. And I think the reaction wasn't treated in a sportsmanlike manner, where you had all this whining, right? Even petitions that we want you to reshoot the show. They're not going to reshoot the show. And it really, I think, dismisses the efforts that they put into it. You know, the 55 nighttime shoots in freezing weather to do the Battle of Winterfell. And for us to just, you know, complain and whine, and for people to be so dismissive because the outcome wasn't what you wanted or what you expected, I think is really disrespectful to everyone involved.
We invest in teams. We invest in shows. We invest in characters. We do whine when it doesn't go our way. And with both athletes and in terms of a show arc that we may not like, we're not trying to see process, right? We want to see results. We are just sitting in front of the TV. We want to be entertained. And when it doesn't, we take to social media.
To bring this back to sports once again, I think that in the same way that you see fans try to, you know, personally contact and criticize on social media an athlete who maybe didn't have a good game, or, you know, the team, you know, just isn't coming together the way that they're supposed to, right, according to the fan. And yeah, I mean, it's wrong when people do that to athletes, and it's wrong when people do that to actors and to showrunners.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Undefeated's Lonnae O'Neill and The Ringer's Claire McNear. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's be real for a second. Some shows need to rely on dragons and zombies and executions to hold your attention. Only A Game doesn't. We just find great stories about real people. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast to make sure you catch all the great stories every week. Thursday, May 7th, 1981, was not a banner day for the Boston Celtics.
Boston right now is 1 of 7 from the field. They now trail 10-2 in this game.
It was Game 2 of the NBA Finals, and the Houston Rockets outplayed the Celtics from the outset. In the first quarter, Boston's all-star center, Robert Parrish, went to the bench with foul trouble. He stayed there most of the game. Rockets center Moses Malone dominated. Celtics backup Rick Roby tried everything he could to stop him. Only a Game's Gary Wallach remembers that game fondly.
At the time, I was a skinny college freshman living a few miles west of the old Boston Garden. Alone in my room, I watched Game 2 on my tiny color TV. The refs had swallowed their whistles, and Moses Malone was turning Rick Roby and the entire Celtics front line inside out. Malone ended the game with 31 points and 15 rebounds.
And the Houston Rockets have evened it up. The Houston Rockets have...
That loss hurt. Food should help, I say to myself. I walk across Beacon Street and order the usual, medium with sweet onions, at the local pizza joint. I drop a quarter into the jukebox. Then the front door opens. This guy walks in. He's about 6'11". He's wearing an ankle-length fur coat. His 10-gallon hat is decorated with a ridiculous arrangement of feathers and Western-style buckles. It's Rick Roby, who I had just watched on TV getting beaten up by Moses Malone and jobbed by the refs. I stifle a smile. He approaches the counter and orders 2 extra-large cheeseburger subs with everything and a large pizza. These were the days well before the team-sponsored post-game buffet. "Hey, Rick," I say. He nods hello from under the brim of his spectacular hat. "What the heck went wrong tonight?" I ask. He shrugs. "I mean, Moses Malone played the entire 48 minutes and was called for just 1 foul, I say. "You had 4 fouls coming off the bench." "Well," Roby says in his Kentucky drawl, "the refs know he's the big star and I'm just the backup center." We chat a little more. He's very pleasant for a guy whose team has just lost a big game. He picks up his order, tips his ridiculous hat, smiles, and he's gone. Over the years, I've wondered if Rick Roby remembered our conversation.
"Well, I really don't."
I have to admit that I'm not surprised he didn't remember me after all these years, but he did remember Game 2 of the 1981 NBA Finals.
"It was a game, I think, that we ended up losing at home. Correct?"
"Correct." And he also recalled something about the refs being just a bit unfair that night.
"In the league, you know, sometimes the big stars can get away with a little bit more than the guys that, you know, are not in the headlines every day."
Roby also acknowledges, somewhat reluctantly, his 1981 fashion choices.
"You know, Bird, McHale, and I, we all, last time we were down in Texas, we all bought these hats, and obviously, I must have worn it because of Houston, so..."
"Do you still have it?"
No, I don't. And I don't have the fur coat either, so..."
"It's probably a good thing, I think."
"That's a good thing."
And there's another thing Roby remembers about that game. It happened at halftime. No one watching on TV could have known. It involved fiery Celtics head coach Bill Fitch.
"Bill Fitch is really in pain. Sciatic nerve in his back. He limps around. He says, 'I've just really been in agony.'"
Fitch, a former Marine drill instructor, suffered from back pain that postseason. He bellowed at his players and at the refs, even more than usual.
"Well, that was the way Bill was. You know, he had a real strong personality, and we weren't playing the right way that night. Fitch that day finally said, 'You know, it was time for me to step in here and try to get people playing.' Fitch came into the locker room, probably as mad as I've ever seen him. He shattered a chalkboard.
After the game, some beat writers saw the remains of that chalkboard with some of the Celtics' plays still drawn up on it. The story made the papers the next morning. When I read about it, I appreciated all the more how friendly Roby had been with me right after the loss.
You see 2 seconds, one, and the world champion, the Boston Celtics.
But things turned out just fine for Rick Roby and his teammates. The Celtics won the 1981 NBA Finals 4-2. Roby even ended up with the Game 6 ball.
I have the actual ball when the buzzer went off. I stuffed it in my gym bag, and then I had read all back, the whole team and all the coaches signed it. And I can always say I have Larry Bird's first championship ball sitting on my shelf.
Things turned out okay for me, too. After many more pizzas with onions, I graduated. The pizza shop is no longer there, which is too bad, but now I sometimes get to talk with people about the NBA Finals and silly hats and chance meetings too weirdly wonderful to ever forget.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. As a kid, Crystal Bodenschatz was one of the country's top gymnasts. Last year, at the age of 32, she told her brother she wanted to start training again.
My first reaction was, oh my God, she's crazy. I went home, talked to my wife about it, and I'm like, I don't know if we have to talk to Crystal. I don't know if there's something wrong, but she wants to train again. What if she gets hurt? Her kids, her husband, like she has bills. She's an adult. She's crazy.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
This week on Rough Translation.
I found out this crazy thing. The word in French for ghostwriter is France's version of the N-word. I literally was like, what?
That story this week on Rough Translation. Take a listen.
I'm J.A. Adande. Next week on Only a Game, what do you do for a Golden State Warriors fan down on his luck? You paint his house blue and gold. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with this week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, J.A.
Charlie, Toronto Raptors star Kawhi Leonard will be a free agent this summer, and local restaurants in the Six have offered him free food for life if he sticks around. Now, the website Narcity reports a real estate brokerage firm is prepared to offer him a luxury penthouse worth millions of dollars if he stays in the North. Is this clever, desperate, or a circumvention of the NBA's salary cap?
I have no idea whether it's a circumvention of the NBA salary cap. It certainly is creative. Who could turn down a luxury penthouse and unlimited takeout Chinese food?
It's kind of desperate, though, isn't it? I mean, you need this one guy. Toronto's a great city with or without Kawhi Leonard, right? Why do you need this guy to stick
around? That's absolutely true. It's one of my favorite cities on the continent. But let them have their fan zone moment, though. I mean, this is a big deal for them. They were expecting to have a Stanley Cup final there this year, and that didn't work out. So, you know, let them have their fun.
Well, Charlie, on Monday, the Golden State Warriors became the first team to reach 5 straight NBA finals since the Boston Celtics did it in the 1960s. Now there's been talk about the Warriors being historically great. And this would certainly be proof of that, right?
Yeah, there are very few of the records set by the Bill Russell Celtics that have fallen in terms of consecutive championship anythings. That's a gigantic moment, really.
I'm a little less impressed by this than some of the other accomplishments, mainly because, I mean, we just had the Cleveland Cavaliers make 4 straight, and we had the Miami Heat make 4 straight before that. Obviously, the Warriors have been making 4 straight during this run. And LeBron has been to 8 straight finals consecutively on his own, right? So, like, talk to me when you get to 8 the way LeBron has with 2 teams.
But if you're beating a record set by the Russell Celtics, you're beating a record, first of all, that stood for over 50 years. And second of all, you're beating a record held by the greatest dynasty in American sports. So I think it's a big deal.
All right. Jalen Rose says that Michigan's hiring of Juwan Howard, his former Wolverines teammate, to be the head basketball coach will lead to a full reunion of the Fab Five. Are you getting warm and fuzzy feelings?
Well, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I think the great stumbling block to this has always been Chris Webber, right?
Right.
The other four are fine with each other, as far as I know. I think Juwan Howard, by the way, is a great hire. I think it's a bit of a gamble, you know, on the experience thing, but it's a gamble worth taking. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of water that has to go under the bridge between these players and the university, these players and the NCAA and these players with each other. So it'll be interesting to watch. I wouldn't be, if I was the Michigan, you know, athletic promotions people, I would arrange for the reunion to take place in the first home game next year. But it's up to the five guys involved.
And also, I guess this means that Howard can get paid by Michigan over the table now.
You're exactly right. For a while, anyway.
I get all excited by this. I was a senior in college when they were Fab Five coming together as freshmen, and I covered them around the Big Ten for the Chicago Sun-Times. I covered Juwan Howard and Chris Webber for the Washington Post when they were with the Washington Bullets, as they were called then. So, you know, the possibility that they could all be reunited and the beef could be squashed has me excited and has me nostalgic.
We'll also find out what Jimmy King's been up to.
Meanwhile, Charlie, in your neck of the woods, the Stanley Cup Finals begin Monday. What angles do you like in Blues versus Bruins?
Tuukka Rask is having a Dryden-esque, Roy-esque, pick-your-goalie-esque playoff series. And they're just better than the Blues, I think.
Well, the angle that stands out to me, of course, is this is the first time these teams have met since the 1970 Stanley Cup Final, which was capped off by that iconic Bobby Orr flying goal. But it just amazes me. You know, that's one of the great sports photos of all time, but it never hit me that that was the demarcation point of the last time the Blues were in the Stanley Cup Final. I mean, this is a you know, supposedly a proud franchise. 1970 was the last time they were in the Stanley Cup Final?
Yeah, and that was back when they were part of that incredible NHL expansion where they added six teams at once. The great thing about that goal, of course, it was that it ended a 4-0 sweep, and the Blues wouldn't have beaten the Bruins if they'd played 15 games that year.
Charlie, the Minnesota Intercollegiate Athletic Conference announced it is kicking out the University of St. Thomas because the Tommies are too dominant across all sports. Is this a case of participation trophy culture run amok?
You know, it's a competitive balance thing, according to the other teams in the league. You know, I feel terrible for St. Thomas. It's a heck of a program. I went up there and wrote about one of their playoff games a couple of years ago and was very charmed by both the staff there and the kids that were playing there. You know, it's Division III. I'm not exactly sure if there's any precedent for this, but it's really kind of, I don't know, there's something awful about it. I can't pull my finger.
Would you want to see the Warriors kicked out because they're dominating the Western Conference?
You know, Alabama's winning too many games in the SEC, so let's kick them out.
And finally, Charlie, the big news story about last week's PGA Championship was Tiger Woods missing the cut by one stroke. But another story leaked out that has some observers reaching for puns. What happened?
Oh, you see, I thought we weren't going to go there. I really thought we were going to play this,
this
one straight.
This is NPR. This is high class.
What did Tiger miss by missing the cut? He missed Jon Rahm getting caught on camera and by his playing partner relieving himself behind a tree, or apparently not behind a tree, which would have been a better idea, I guess. You know, I presume he's not the first PGA professional who's done this, and probably won't be the last.
Probably the first on camera, though, right? And hopefully the last in that regard.
As we know, J.A., the camera is never off these days. Don't do anything you don't want a couple of tens of millions of people to see on the intertubes.
Sometimes less coverage and less high definition, right? We could have gone without the HD for
high
that shot. Right?
High def is not your friend in these instances, no.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, J.A.
Years ago, Crystal Bodenschatz was a gymnast at the peak of her career. She had dreams of making an Olympic team, and she was just 14 years old. Like a lot of gymnasts, Crystal retired young. She moved on, finished high school, started a family. But recently, Crystal discovered something.
You don't have to be 16, 17, try for the Olympics, stop, and you're done.
Amy Sisk of member station WESA has the story.
Crystal Bodenschatz sprinted toward the vault at the 2000 National Gymnastics Championships in St. Louis. She had a lot of eyes on her.
My parents, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins.
They cheered from the stands while a panel of USA Gymnastics officials looked on.
All the head people are sitting there, you know, watching you, and you're right next to them.
She launched off the vault into a flip with a half twist and nailed her landing. And then she waited.
We get called to go in the back for awards, and you have to line up. And every championships, they would, they'd call from last to first. And here I'm waiting, like, oh, maybe I got third, you know. You know, and they call third up, and I'm like, ooh, maybe I got second. Like, I never really knew.
She won gold. After the meet, Crystal met up with her family. All she wanted was a meal. But as they left the arena...
people swarmed us.
That's Crystal's brother, Johnny Uslak.
We needed, like, bodyguards almost. And can we have your autograph? And, like, just hundreds of kids.
And we could barely walk, you know, you felt like a celebrity, you know, and even my brother, people were asking him for his autograph because he was my brother.
You know, that's kind of when it hit home, like, wow, you know, I think I could see my sister in the Olympics.
Crystal was one of the country's top gymnasts, but she was too young to compete in the Sydney Games later that summer. She set her sights on the 2004 Olympics in Athens, and she kept winning.
This is America's most promising fresh face, the two-time junior national champion, but this is a big step.
Crystal trained at Parkettes in Allentown, Pennsylvania, a gym with a reputation for being tough.
They were pushing me really hard, and I was trying to, I think I was becoming a teenager too, so things weren't just happening easy like they did before in the past. And I think I just got frustrated with my coaches, and they got frustrated with me.
One day at practice in 2003, Crystal's coaches wanted her to do a double layout in a floor routine, two flips with a straight body requiring a lot of power. Crystal wasn't feeling up to it. She didn't want to end up like other gymnasts who would get injured trying moves that they couldn't land safely and consistently. Crystal went back into the locker room, but she says her coach followed and said,
"This Olympics is not for you anymore. This is all about me." I walked out right then. I remember calling my mom, saying, "I'm done. I quit."
Crystal didn't stay away long. She started training again. But in January 2004, she missed catching the high bar on a release skill and fell to the mat below. She felt a bone pop out of place, then slide back in.
You couldn't even see my foot. Like, it was so big. So I stayed off of it. Gosh, like, maybe 2 weeks, if that. And it was not okay. Like, it was still hurt, still swollen. I could barely walk.
Crystal wasn't healthy enough to try her most difficult skills at her next big competitions, and she didn't make the 2004 Olympic team. When the Athens Games came around that August, she didn't even watch on TV.
I hated gymnastics. I hated everything about it. I just was done with it.
Crystal had a full-ride scholarship to compete in college, but after freshman year, she quit and returned home to Johnstown, Pennsylvania. She began coaching at her family's gym, Uslak Gymnastics. Years passed. She got married and had three kids. Last June, at age 32, Crystal drove across the state to visit her old gym, Parkettes, for its 50th anniversary.
You know, got to see my friends, and I got to, like, show my husband some of the pictures and, you know, videos of when I was younger. And talking about gymnastics, you know, it just brought back a lot of memories, because I don't ever really talk about my experience as a gymnast ever.
When she got back to Johnstown, Crystal hopped up on the balance beam in front of the girls she was coaching, and she decided to show off a crazy skill from her competition days. A full twisting back handspring landing not on her feet, but catching the beam between her legs. Many people who see it performed for the first time gasp because it looks terrifying. But she pulled it off.
But after that, for 2 weeks, I couldn't move my shoulder.
But Crystal had fun trying it, and this idea began creeping into her head. Could she make a comeback?
Why not? Why not try? Might be really, really hard, but I think this would be, like, the perfect time to try. I mean, I started trying to work out at my house, doing conditioning and going outside because it was still nice out, and doing handstands and pirouettes and all of that, and maybe convince myself that I could still do it.
Crystal's brother, Donnie, coaches at the family's gym, too.
My first reaction was, oh, my God, you gotta, no, she's crazy. I went home, talked to my wife about it, and I'm like, I don't know if we have to talk to Crystal. I don't know if there's something wrong, but she wants to train again. What if she gets hurt? Her kids, her husband, like, she has bills. She's an adult. She can't. She's crazy.
But Crystal had made up her mind. Donnie and their mom eventually became her coaches, helping her prepare routines for a sport that's changed a lot in 15 years.
It's very powerful. It's very let's try the hardest things and put them all together.
Crystal didn't have any of the right gear to get started, just an old, worn set of leather grips that gymnasts wear over their hands on bars.
So I got new grips and new leotards, and really that's all you need for gymnastics, not much more.
Earlier this year, Crystal entered the Buckeye Classic in Ohio. It was her first elite competition since 2004. Girls from her gym and her family, including her three young children, sat in the stands. Most of her competitors were 12, 13, 14 years old.
All the other girls in her rotation were like staring at her like, oh my God, who is this lady?
But one of their coaches knew.
She's like, excuse me, are you Crystal? She's like, yep. She's like the Crystal? And she's like, yeah, I guess if you want to say that, I'm the Crystal. She's like, do you have anything inspirational to say to my girls? And I don't remember exactly what she said, but she told the girls, you know, have fun and be yourself. And the look on the little girls like, oh, my God, I'm competing against this former gymnast who's, like, amazing.
Crystal started on vault.
Everyone was clapping for me when I was running down the vault runway and cheering. I could hear all that, and you know, that was exciting.
She completed her piked flip with a half twist and took just a small step on her landing. Then she went to her next and final event, balance beam.
You know, I got up on the beam, shaking, like really shaking.
One of her toughest moves came early in her routine, a back handspring followed by a backflip. She went a touch crooked and fell onto the mat.
So I get back up and I go to do my next thing and I feel very confident.
But as she moved through her choreography, she took a sidestep and found herself on the floor yet again.
I was just like, oh my gosh, what happened? How did I end up on the ground?
She wobbled the rest of the way through the routine.
So when I landed, like, I just burst into tears and walked away.
In the days after the competition, her perspective changed, and news of her comeback spread throughout the gymnastics community. One 16-year-old gymnast was thinking about leaving the sport when she read a Facebook post about Crystal's journey.
She didn't quit because of my story. That's enough. You know, if I reached, you know, these people to want to keep doing stuff, that to me is enough.
Since the Buckeye Classic, Crystal has kept working out and competing. Donnie says he catches a lot of the young gymnasts at the family's gym staring at his sister, amazed every time she trains.
Whenever she's working out, it's like, girls, hello, girls, come on, back to practice.
Crystal's goal is to represent the United States at the Tokyo Games in 2020. The odds are against her. Over the last five Olympics, the U.S. hasn't sent any gymnasts older than 26. But her Olympic dream still motivates her.
Hopefully by next year, I will improve all of these routines so they're up to what everyone is doing. Right now, yes, I'm not at that point, but I want to get out in front of people just to show them that I can do it.
Crystal knows her dream may never come true, and she's okay with that. This journey has become a lot bigger than fulfilling that childhood goal.
Just finding the love of something again, feeling happy, and every day doing something that makes me happy and makes me smile is the best part of doing this again.
That story came from reporter Amy Sisk in Pittsburgh. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm J.A. Adande. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.